these two young men that had such promising futures literally watched as they believe their life fell apart.
Coverage of the Steubenville verdict this week revealed a culture still deeply conflicted about rape. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. We know personal finance pundits like Jim Cramer aren't gods, but how ungodlike are they actually?
When people look at his record, the best thing you could actually do is, the second he says to buy something, is to immediately short it or bet against it.
Plus, in precedent-setting legal cases, lawyers handpick poster child plaintiffs. Do lazy journalists get suckered by a simplistic storyline?
Maybe sometimes we don't question or dig deep enough when the plaintiff is sympathetic.
That and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, offering tools to create a website, blog, or online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create a professional website. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
We begin this hour with a verdict in the Steubenville sexual assault case. Just about an hour ago, a judge in the Ohio steel town delivered the verdict.
Last Sunday saw a guilty verdict in the case of two high school football stars, Malik Richmond and Trent Mays, who were accused of raping a 16-year-old girl in Steubenville, Ohio. For 6 hours, the severely intoxicated victim was dragged from party to party by a number of her peers, a humiliating journey photographed and joked about by the accused and others on sites such as Instagram and Twitter. The case became a national media event when these posts on social media were later used against the accused in court. This is CNN's Poppy Harlow.
This tweet from a partygoer reads, "Song of the night is definitely Rape Me by Nirvana." Other tweets call the girl sloppy and talk about a dead body, referring to the girl's state of unconsciousness.
But once the verdict came in, the media quickly became part of the story. First, there was outrage over the live-on-the-scene coverage of the verdict from CNN's Harlow again for dwelling on the misfortune for the convicted rapists.
As these two young men that had such promising futures, star football players, very good students, literally watched as they believe their life fell apart. One of the young men, Malik Richmond, when that sentence came down, he collapsed. He collapsed in the arms of his attorney, Walter Madison. He said to him, "My life is over. No one is going to want me now."
By the next day, MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN had all inadvertently broadcast the name of the teenage victim, contrary to journalistic standards of anonymity for both children and rape victims. And social media quickly became part of the story again after the verdict, when sympathy for the rapists echoed around the Twitter sphere, including threats against the victim. Here's Headline News Network's Kira Phillips.
Listen to these tweets. "You ripped my family apart. You made my cousin cry. So when I see you bleep, it's going to be a homicide. And here's one more. I'll celebrate by beating the expletive out of Jane Doe."
For all the horror and emotion engendered by Steubenville, the episode created an opportunity for reflection about the culture of impunity for athletes, the culture of casual misogyny among youth, and the overall society's persistent ambivalence about sexual violence. Some commentators wondered this week whether Steubenville is a crossroads or a blip. Amanda Marcotte, who writes for Slate's Double X Factor blog, acknowledges the signals are mixed, but sees a reason for hope.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm seeing more discussion than I ever have before in the mainstream media about the cultural context in which rape happens. A lot more people are talking about what happened, not as a few bad apples making bad choices, so much as talking about the culture of male entitlement, athletics, the sort of societal support for rapists over their victims and victim blaming that allows rape to continue. And this is going on in a way that I've never quite seen before. Also, I'm beginning to see a lot more people talking about rape as an act of humiliation and an act of dominance. And the traditional discussion where many people assume that rape is a matter of a man just having too much sexual desire and acting out that way, I'm not really seeing that as much a part of this discussion as it usually is.
How do you reconcile that with the reaction in Steubenville itself over the course of the investigation and the prosecution, where much of the community rallied around these young men who were accused of these crimes, and a kind of virtual Steubenville online, which evinced similar sympathy for the boys and a lot of blame on the teenage victim of this prolonged night of rape and humiliation?
With Steubenville, it's not unsurprising. I think the closer people are to the crime, often the more tendency there is to blame the victim and exonerate the rapist. And the reason is pretty simple. We don't want to believe that our community creates rapists, our direct community. So when we discover, when we have evidence presented in front of us that it's the way our culture is, and in this case, the way that Steubenville is with the teenage entitlement, the football worship, the sort of giving these young men a blank check to do whatever they want, Steubenville has been confronted with evidence that this kind of behavior creates rape, and that is something that is very difficult to believe, that is very difficult to understand. And so the natural reaction for a lot of people is to just deny it and blame the victim for speaking out instead of blame the rapists and to blame themselves for letting this happen.
Cognitive dissonance, in other words.
Yes.
Now, I want to bring up the CNN coverage. You've seen the tape in which correspondent Poppy Harlow and anchor Candy Crowley have a conversation which is astonishingly sympathetic of the young men who have been convicted and their plight and whether their lives have been ruined and so on. Just a jaw-dropping episode. Do you think this undermines your best hopes for where the culture is, or is just cable TV being cable, reporting on what it's seeing at the moment in the moment?
You know, I honestly don't think Candy Crowley and Poppy Harlow meant to do that. I think it was in large part just because that was exactly what was happening right now. And it is hard watching a couple teenage boys cry like that. And they lost themselves for a moment. And I think the reason that they did is because that our culture has not really completely absorbed the message that rape is a horrific crime in every single instance, that it becomes easy to start sliding over into sympathizing with the rapist in this situation. That said, what happened after the CNN report was there was this complete outpouring of anger at them for this and for not mentioning the victim. A number of media outlets criticized them for it. There's a change.org petition against them for it. So I think there was so much anger and overwhelming criticism of the CNN segment that I do kind of feel like people are really truly beginning to get it.
Amanda, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Amanda Marcotte writes for Slate's Double X Factor blog. Even as the media and public fitfully reckoned with the Steubenville verdict, a nauseatingly similar narrative played out in the town of Torrington, Connecticut. There, three teenage players stand accused of sexual acts with two 13-year-old girls. As in Steubenville, a lot of bullying and ridicule of the victims has taken place on social media. Unlike the Steubenville case, the local paper, the Connecticut Register Citizen, chose to publish the bullying tweets of high school students with their Twitter handles and images unredacted. The editor of the paper, Matt DiRenzo, wrote about the decision to print the names of minors.
We could have written the story by summarizing this stuff, saying a group of kids, describing who the kids were. But we felt that the reaction to that the next day would be, that's not my kid. You know, those are the bad kids. What we wanted to show was that, to the contrary, this was male students, female students, honor roll students. This was a widespread, pervasive thing. And we wanted to show the public and their parents what these two 13-year-old girls were seeing when they went on Twitter. And we felt it was also the only way that the schools would act.
But, you know, I have to point out that in your paper, you have had stories about bomb threats, about attempted arsons, about robbery, in which juvenile suspects were not named because of the general canon of protection for minor children who presumably are not equipped to make mature adult decisions and be held responsible for them in perpetuity. Why does bullying online cross a barrier that alleged arson does not?
Well, for one thing, the arsonist is not signing their name with a message to it on the town green or whatever, right? And if they were, that would be part of the story and they probably would be identified. And it's also, those kind of crimes are not this mob mentality that shows a systemic issue with the community. What's really at stake here is the fact that a huge percentage of the student body in Torrington believes that statutory rape is not real rape and that it's okay to call a 13-year-old a whore for reporting it.
But you certainly could have written exactly the same story by using the same images of the tweets, obscuring the faces and the handles, and just doing a little summary reporting of the demographics and the rough categorization of the tweeters. You could have given the context without actually naming the kids behind it. How close were you to making that decision?
No, we absolutely discussed it. But we believe that if we had gone that route, the tweets and the harassment and the bullying would have continued, because parents wouldn't have woken up to it and the kids would be able to continue to hide behind anonymity, which is even kind of a silly conversation since they're publicly tweeting. You know.
Well, that does raise a question. Do you think publicly tweeting, in effect publishing for the world your views, is a de facto waiver of any protections that you would be afforded as a child?
I do think that, within reason.
Do you think that in this day of online publishing, that even the old standards of withholding the names of minors no longer apply because the identities are going to be revealed anyway?
Not necessarily, and I think it misses the point of this. We know about the problem, the real problem, which is this attitude towards rape and consent because of Twitter. And that's the new part, because Twitter is broadcasting. That's how we know about it. But the problem is the problem.
What kind of backlash is the Register Citizen facing?
We're getting a ton of criticism from the kids because they're seeing their friends take a lot of grief for engaging in this kind of behavior. From adults, we're seeing a ton of support. And maybe we just haven't heard from the specific parents of these kids that were named. But in general, the adult community in Torrington is horrified by this. Their eyes are open by it. And they support the girls in this situation. And their eyes are open about the attitudes of the kids. They feel like it's an issue that needs to be dealt with head on. And they do not have a whole lot of sympathy for these kids being embarrassed by what they said on Twitter.
What you've done here is, at least in terms of process, a kind of journalistic advocacy. You've broken a rule in the name of a larger good. Are you comfortable now that I'm calling you an advocacy journalist?
I am totally 100% comfortable with that. How could you not advocate for protecting 13-year-old girls from being bullied and called a whore for reporting a sexual assault?
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt DiRenzo is editor of the Connecticut Register Citizen. Coming up, the good news about journalism, it isn't extinct yet. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, providing ways to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Pew Project for Excellence in Journalism released its annual State of the News Media report, detailing the health, or in this case, the frailty, of mainstream U.S. media, online and off. The report contained a litany of grim statistics about the consumption and economics of news that makes some of us think dark thoughts. But Associate Director Mark Jerkowitz says the situation isn't as bleak as it could be.
No, there's no need to put your head in the oven at this point. The actual raw data from 2012 is not all that negative in terms of digital, local television, cable news. Revenues were up slightly or more. We've actually seen the newspaper industry fundamentally stabilize its circulation. So the raw numbers don't tell you that this is in an industry in collapse.
You see the glass is half full. I see shards in a puddle on the floor. Audience for news, especially TV news, is down across the board. Newsroom cutbacks continue. Employment in the industry is down 30% since 2012. 40% of what you see in broadcast is sports, weather, and traffic, not community news. On cable news, there's not much news. There's a lot of talk about the news, but the live reporting has fallen yet again. What part of this report should not make me panic?
Well, Bob, I'll give you a lot of credit for isolating all the trouble spots. You did an excellent job at that, and I wouldn't gloss over any of them. If we're looking for optimism, let's say in the newspaper industry, we know what the problem has been for newspapers, and I think it may become a problem for local television too, and that is the failure for digital advertising revenues to grow. Last year for newspapers, it was an anemic 3%. So what has the newspaper industry done in the past year that's notable? Well, it seems like the theological debate over whether content should be free or not has about come to an end. We now count about 450 American dailies that have now erected some kind of digital paid subscription plan. And that holds out some real hope. At the New York Times right now, they are actually making more on circulation revenue than they are in advertising revenue. That may be part of a way forward for news organizations if they can make this digital paid content experiment work. There's a ray of optimism right there for you.
Thank you for the ray. And if you want more rays, check out a piece by Matt Iglesias in Slate in which he says that despite the financial extremis in which most news organizations find themselves, this is just the absolute golden age for news content consumers.
It's hard to argue that consumers don't have more choices now than they had before, but we think the bottom line is that quality journalism costs money, and if there isn't a viable business plan going for commercial journalism, then sooner or later there are going to be significant impacts that all but the most perhaps well-heeled or discerning and energetic news consumers are going to feel.
You referred to the low advertising rates on the digital side compared to the extremely lucrative advertising rates that made media barons back in the good old days. Is there any hope for an increase in the so-called CPMs, the cost per thousands that advertisers pay, or are online news organizations going to be forever victimized by the law of supply and demand?
The whole decoupling of news from advertising may be what we're going to be seeing to a large extent going forward in the digital world, which means diversifying revenue sources. So what are the other options aside from building up digital advertising revenue to the extent that you can? And that's probably going to mean things like much more video re-advertising and much more smart targeted display advertising. But there are a couple other businesses that are happening in digital. One of them that we already have talked about, which is paid subscription model. And that's going to be an increasingly important part of the digital business model.
There was one finding in the Pew study I thought was just positively jaw-dropping, and that is that 60% of Americans say that they've heard little or nothing about the financial problems besetting news organizations. I've been curled up in a fetal position for about 7 years, and the public hasn't even noticed, you know, that the Des Moines Register is about the size and thickness of my weekly reader.
Bob, the only thing I'm going to say is it proves without a doubt that you're only getting 40% of America to listen to your show. I mean, which is really the issue. But, you know, there is another finding that goes along with that that's worth mentioning. And that is that we did ask the question, have you abandoned a specific news outlet because it no longer provides you the news and information to which you've become accustomed? And there we had about 31% of the respondents say that they had done that. And it's interesting that when you do the crosstab, you find out that the people who are most aware of the financial problems are the ones who are most likely to leave a news outlet.
Now, we began this conversation where you had a half-full glass. Nothing you have said since then has evinced the remotest bit of optimism on your part. Just how full is that glass again?
Look, these are obviously very tough times for the news industry, but the asteroid or the meteor has not eradicated yet what has existed previously. And the cable news model, again, and I know you cast some aspersions on that, is fairly solid. Network television, you know, this is a classic case where for the last 10 years, everybody's been wondering when the evening newscasts are going to go off the air. They're not going off the air. They still get good-sized audiences. The huge question that's hitting some sectors before others is obviously digital revenue. But at the same time, it hasn't destroyed the infrastructure of the media as we now know it.
Mark, thank you very much.
Bob, it's always a pleasure.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Pew Project for Excellence in Journalism. Sometime in the next few months, the Supreme Court will decide the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin. At issue is whether the University of Texas should be able to use race as a factor in undergraduate admission. Abigail Fisher, who is white, claims the university's admissions policy discriminated against her because of her race in not admitting her in 2008. Fisher is a strawberry blonde, fresh-faced poster child for reverse discrimination. But ProPublica reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones says her story and profile are more appealing than her argument.
Abigail Fisher would actually have a very difficult time proving that she was discriminated against. There were far more Black and Latino students who were not accepted with worse grades and test scores than Abigail Fisher than there were who were. There were only 5 Black and Latino students offered provisional admission with worse grades than Abigail Fisher, and there were 168 who had better.
Whether or not she really genuinely deserves the standing that she's been accorded in this case, she's just a fantastic symbol of the alleged harm of affirmative action.
She makes a great plaintiff. You really want to pick a pristine plaintiff who is going to elicit a great deal of sympathy and outrage. And Abigail Fisher is a good plaintiff in that way. She has a very girlish, innocent look about her. She has a great story about working very hard and being turned away.
This is not the first time that a photogenic, publicity-friendly plaintiff has been used to seek the sympathies of the public in a case like this. In fact, your piece says that the political right in bankrolling this case has borrowed a page from the civil rights movement itself.
You had groups like the NAACP and other civil rights groups wanting to challenge racial segregation. And in order to do that with a very conflicted public, they had to put forth a plaintiff that would be both sympathetic and who would elicit outrage at kind of the injustice of the law. In the landmark Brown versus Board of Education, Oliver Brown became the first name of that lawsuit. He was a hardworking welder and assistant pastor in Topeka, Kansas. First, they were challenging largely segregation in higher ed. So they were picking people who are applying into doctorate programs or people who are applying to be law students. So these were people that it would be very difficult to kind of pick apart. It was easy to have sympathy for people who were in the middle class, who served in the military and were trying to access the American dream.
The narrative on Abigail Fisher is that she had her heart set on being a Texas Longhorn from the time she was in second grade. Her father and other members of her family had attended Texas, and this was her dream, scotched because of reverse discrimination. But did she file this suit on her own? Was she kind of dug up by interested third parties who were looking for someone to stand for the class of the white aggrieved?
She did not think up this suit on her own, and there's no reason to believe that absent a conservative activist by the name of Edward Blum, that we'd even know who Abigail Fisher is. Edward Blum has spent the last 20 years bringing court cases against any race-conscious programs in various sectors of the government, and he was looking for a case to challenge affirmative action.
Do you know how he became aware of Abigail Fisher?
After the Supreme Court in 2003 upheld very narrowly affirmative action for the means of diversity, the University of Texas, which had been using a top 10 program, which allowed automatic admission for the top 10% of any graduating high school class in the state of Texas, they then reinstated an affirmative action program on top of that. After the University of Texas did that, Edward Blum began shopping around for a plaintiff to challenge that affirmative action program. So he put the word out that he was looking for someone. And Abigail Fisher is actually the daughter of a childhood acquaintance of his.
You understand why litigants would want to serve up a palatable dish, right? But this only works if the public and the press buys in. Can you give me an example of the kind of coverage that utterly bought into the notion of Abigail Fisher as the ideal poster child?
On the day that the Supreme Court granted cert to the Fisher case, there was a story on the front page of the Houston Chronicle. It started off with, the University of Texas enrolled 10,335 minority students, and for Abigail Fisher, that was one too many. It then went on to say that with this case, Fisher might be getting a little payback. It seemed like the story was already saying that she was justified, that there was a slot that was hers that was taken, and that she was now going to be able to get some kind of vengeance for losing her spot. That's what caused me to start digging into the coverage. A lot of coverage did address that University of Texas said that Abigail Fisher wouldn't have gotten in regardless of her race, that her grades just weren't good enough. What it didn't get is that Abigail Fisher and her counsel do not deny that. And that's important. It's not just a he say, she said. They actually don't deny that they have no way of knowing whether or not race cost Abigail Fisher her spot and that there were white students who got in with worse grades than her. And I think that's very important.
So what should have the media done here instead of what we did do?
What reporters are expected to do is just write about the big picture. I didn't have to write deadline stories on this ruling. I had a lot of questions coming from the coverage, namely, how does Abigail Fisher know that students with worse grades than her were getting in? And so what I did was I went to the court documents. And when I read the court documents, I found that the arguments were quite different than what the coverage is. And I think the lesson for all of us is that maybe sometimes we don't question or dig deep enough when the plaintiff is sympathetic. And I think that that's something that all of us as journalists need to consider.
Nicole, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a reporter at ProPublica. There are poster children and there are poster children. What if you argued that anti-hacking laws, such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, are unduly harsh on crimes that ultimately protect us all by exposing security vulnerabilities? There would seem to be no better cause celeb than Andrew Weave Orenheimer, who was sentenced this week to 3.5 years in prison for hacking AT&T's website. 3+ years in prison. Isn't that just the kind of sentence that we've been told terrified Aaron Swartz into committing suicide while awaiting trial for illegally downloading a trove of academic files? The problem with Andrew Orenheimer, though, poster child-wise, is that he is an unapologetic troll. Here he was in February talking to WNYC's New Tech City.
I think that the people in power deserve to have their lives ruined. They are thieves. They are seditious thugs. They are liars and they are criminals. And one day there will be courts with integrity to bring them to justice.
Gawker's Adrian Chan has been reporting on Weave's case. Adrian, welcome to On the Media.
Hi, Bob.
So what did this guy do exactly?
He conspired to exploit a security flaw in a public website from AT&T and used a special computer program to harvest over 110,000 email and login credentials and ID numbers from iPad owners.
And having discovered this security flaw, he immediately got in touch with AT&T and said, "Hey, guys, you've got a problem. I've found the problem. I have got all of these email files, and I'm going to turn them over to you. Would you just fix this up for the sake of all of us, right?"
Well, no, and that's kind of where he got in trouble. He claims that he contacted AT&T, but that's in dispute. What he did for sure was email a reporter at Gawker, where I work now, and told him we found this vulnerability in AT&T, and he turned over the list of all of the email addresses and iPad IDs that they'd taken. And we published a redacted version of some of those to show that AT&T had this vulnerability.
This was not his first time in the public eye. Weave is kind of a notorious figure in the black hat hacking community. Tell me about him.
He's kind of the godfather of internet trolling as we think of it today. He was the subject of a big New York Times article about internet trolls in 2008, where he was quoted saying all sorts of horrible things like, "I'm a life ruiner and I just do things to get a rise out of people." He's been known for just saying totally offensive things in order to get attention and reactions from people, and he's been doing this for years.
So if one were to make the case that these hackers ultimately are serving some sort of civic good by finding these security flaws, he's not the guy you would want to testify at the Senate Commerce Committee, for example.
No, you certainly wouldn't. And even within the computer security industry, which is generally supportive of Weave, his tactics are very controversial. I mean, he didn't give enough notice to AT&T and kind of was a real jerk about how he went about exposing this flaw.
Adrian, in the introduction, I referred to Aaron Swartz, who was facing jail time himself over what his defense anyway said was a categorically unmalicious hack of some academic records. The circumstances of his suicide aren't necessarily as clear-cut as his supporters would argue, but whatever sympathy he was able to generate for rethinking the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, have they been utterly undone by Weave?
No, I don't think that this case has undone any of the goodwill sparked by Aaron Swartz. If anything, it's allowed people who are trying to reform the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to sort of tease out the issues, because ideally the issues surrounding this act, which is that it's too broad and too harsh, should be separate from the motives and the personality of the defendants. And you see people like the Electronic Frontier Foundation coming out and saying, you know, we don't support the horrible things that he said, but this law is bad and his punishment is unjustified, just like Aaron Swartz was.
Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adrian Chen covered the case of Andrew Weave Arnheimer for Gawker. Coming up, what not to type when chatting on China's version of Skype. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For years, we've been reporting on the Great Firewall of China, the digital security apparatus that eavesdrops on and sometimes blocks online chatter. And we've long known a handful of the search terms that have been targeted by government censors. Falun Gong, for example. Tiananmen Square. Now we're getting even more insight into what words get flagged, thanks to computer science graduate student Jeffrey Knuckle, who, using one word on the Chinese version of Skype, known as Tom Skype, has been able to divine thousands of words and phrases that get Skype chat users put under surveillance.
Well, it was the F word. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on a
It was the F word. So how did you do it?
We knew that the F word was triggering surveillance based on some previous work. So what we did was we redirected Tom Skype. Instead of downloading the list of encrypted words from Tom's servers, we had it download the list of encrypted words that we gave it. So we initially started out with just the regular list of encrypted words that it would have gotten anyways. And then we used a technique called binary search, where you divide the list in half repeatedly. So what we would do is we would delete, say, the first half of the list. If this word was still triggering surveillance after we deleted the first half of the list, then we knew it was on the second half. We can repeat this process until we know exactly which line on the list corresponds to the F word.
And before long, you had come up with such subversive terminology as Human Rights Watch, Reporters Without Borders, BBC News. But then there were others that seemed to be less about political threats than kind of moral turpitude issues, like kinky cinema and hired killer, two girls, one cup, and a bunch of other swear words in addition to the big F.
Two girls, one cup is one of the more surprising keywords that we found on there. If our audience isn't aware, this refers to an obscene sexual video that made its rounds on the internet a couple years ago.
Now, you know that this flagging system is built into Tom Skype. Do you know for certain that Tom Skype turns this information over to the state or to the party?
We don't know what they do with this information after they get it. All we see is the information being sent to Tom's servers. They could be a lot more transparent. One problem is that if, say, I'm using Skype and I'm talking to another person using Tom's Skype, the text messages that I'm sending them are still being surveilled just by virtue that they're all going in and out of the person's Tom Skype client that I'm talking to. There's no indication that, you know, warning the messages may be under surveillance.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Canockle is a graduate student in computer science at the University of New Mexico. China's Skype surveillance isn't particularly surprising. What is surprising is that Skype is owned by Microsoft, and Microsoft is a founding member, along with Yahoo and Google, of the Global Network Initiative, an organization whose purpose is to develop best practices for working with authoritarian governments and to protect people's internet privacy. Ethan Zuckerman is director of MIT's Center for Civic Media. He says that the Global Network Initiative, or GNI, came about after a very troubling incident involving a Chinese journalist.
It was founded very specifically in the wake of Yahoo's difficulties with the arrest of Xu Tao, a Chinese journalist who was arrested using data that Yahoo's Chinese partner released to Chinese authorities.
It seems to me it all boils down to the China conundrum that we've struggled with since Nixon. Whether you let a society run in isolation or try to walk it step by step into a democratic Western world. But Microsoft isn't a government, it's a company. Does that change the calculus at all?
They see the services that they are providing as having immense value to people within China. And they would argue that on aggregate, Chinese citizens are better having access to these powerful tools of communication than they were if those companies pulled out altogether.
Which was Nixon's rationale in opening China.
Sure. Now, the flip side to this is that these organizations also have users in the U.S., users in Europe, who are alarmed when they hear a story like the one that Jeffrey Canockle has brought back to our attention about censorship of keywords within Skype chat. This is the situation that Skype has been dealing with since 2008. And they've not found a way to either end their partnership with Tom, the Chinese company that's doing the censorship, or to decide that they're not going to offer that text chat service in China. And to me, that does raise some questions about whether these discussions that are taking place at GNI, which are very important, end up in some cases being a delaying tactic rather than making a difficult choice to either cut off a service or to take the human rights hit around it.
Apart from pulling out altogether, is there a half measure that the Global Network Initiative or anyone else has identified that can, you know, at least make the surveillance more transparent?
Absolutely. There are best and worst practices that you can take on. Google, when it was operating search engines within China, made sure that when they were forced to remove results, they stated at the bottom of the page that a number of results had been removed, which is significantly more transparent than simply removing those results and simply pretending those sites don't exist. Another best practice was to recognize that there are certain services like search that are not especially sensitive, and other services like email that are enormously sensitive. And that in the case of those very sensitive services, to ensure that those servers are outside of China so that they're immune to subpoena or other pressure. Now, when Skype went into that joint venture, they did not undertake that best practice. And evidently, at this point, they still have not made major changes on those fronts.
Now, if one were cynical, one could join or even co-found an organization like the Global Network Initiative and with one hand talk about seeking best practices for doing business with authoritarian regimes, and on the other hand, being entirely compliant and letting the surveillance go on virtually unmolested, which is to say a fig leaf or sort of human rights washing. Do I have any reason to be skeptical of Microsoft's motives here?
I have no reason to believe that Microsoft is acting in bad faith. Certainly to the extent that I've been privy to discussions in organizations like GNI, there are really intense conversations within these large internet multinationals about what you do in China. What I would say is that I think it's really important that the general public, the users of these services, keeps a really close eye and keeps pressure on these companies and sort of says, look, we're watching. And if we're not getting answers about this, we're going to start asking questions about whether GNI is effective or whether it's a fig leaf.
All right. Ethan, as always, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
Ethan Zuckerman is director of MIT's Center for Civic Media and co-founder of the citizen media organization Global Voices Online. Microsoft declined to be interviewed but sent us this statement, quote, "In China, the Skype software is made available through a joint venture with Tom Online. As the majority partner in the joint venture, Tom Online has established procedures to meet its obligations under local laws. Even as a minority partner, we understand we also have responsibilities. Microsoft is working to adopt appropriate changes that can be made to address the issues raised." Turns out you need money to survive, but maybe you don't earn enough of it to do so worry-free, much less be sure you're provided for in your retirement years. The consequence is a lot of anxiety, confusion, and often a lot of very poor decision-making. But none of us is in this quandary alone. A vast and voracious personal finance industry has evolved with promises to put our financial houses in order. This includes a whole genre of personal finance media, Jim Cramer, Susie Orman, and the rest. But much of this industry, says Helene Olin, author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, is built on a fundamental lie.
Right. For more than 30 years, our incomes have stagnated and fallen. Our net worth fell 40% between 2007 and 2010 alone. In the current run-up on the Dow, the vast majority of the gains went to the top 1%, followed by the top 10% of the population. And at the same time, there's this whole vast industry out there that's saying, we have the secret, we can tell you what to do, and you're going to get ahead. I always say personal finance can help you, but it can't save you.
Now, there are certain principles of personal finance advice that are unimpeachable, right? Save if you can. If you invest in the stock market, do so at the same rate over time and let the laws of market averaging take hold. Let's see what else. If you're going to buy a mutual fund, get a no-load fund. Don't pay a management fee. Is there anything wrong with dispensing that kind of advice?
Not really, though. There's two different things that go on. First, a lot of people aren't dispensing that kind of advice. There are people on the radio every day trying to tell you why load funds are a good idea. Dave Ramsey, one of the big gurus out there, is one that did that this week, actually. The other part is the idea that the stock market's going to do well for us over time is to forget the line that's on every prospectus out there, which is past performance is no guarantee of future returns. In the 1990s, people were telling us quite routinely to expect 10 to 12% average annual returns. Japan's stock market, for example, hasn't gone much of anywhere for more than two decades now.
What about the big brand name personal finance gurus? I'm talking about Susie Orman, for example. She's not on your Christmas card list.
I don't believe so. Susie Orman is basically quite conflicted. She's, for instance, marketing her own prepaid debit card. She, at one point, was saying to people that she had hoped it would be used for future credit score references. But when you went to her website, there was a huge disclaimer saying that usage of the card would not be used to determine one's credit score.
Because it wasn't a credit card. It was essentially a prepaid debit card.
Indeed, which is a very different beast. Probably, however, the person whose advice is really just out there is a guy named Robert Kiyosaki. Kiyosaki was one of the big gurus of the past decade. This whole idea that you don't need school smarts to get ahead, you need to learn how to increase your cash flow.
Now, best-selling author and financial expert Robert Kiyosaki shows you the secrets to generating a lifetime of passive income through real estate investment.
And one of the ways to increase your cash flow was to buy houses with no money down and flip them and, you know, move on to the next house. People who had bought houses following Kiyosaki, for instance, some of them had taken advances on credit cards to come up with the down payment. We all know what happened. The housing market began to leak air and then crashed altogether, and people lost an awful lot of money.
And yet he's still out there hustling.
Kiyosaki gets that people don't want to cut back, that they need to increase their cash flow. So he's telling you, it's okay to aspire to this great life of luxury. I'm going to show you the way to make more money. He gets at something that many other personal finance gurus don't. Susie Orman on her show told people they can't afford to have second children, as though this was a consumer item. Dave Ramsey or David Bach, who is the man who came up with the latte factor, they're telling you to cut back and cut back and cut back.
Tell me about the latte factor, because this is simply phenomenal.
The latte factor starts in the mid-1990s, and his idea is if you give up your $5 a day latte and you put that money in an account where it will grow at 12% average annual returns, you will retire with between $1 and $2 million over the next 30 to 40 years.
Okay, I've got several questions about that, Helene.
Okay.
First, where does a latte cost $5? Secondly, where do you get a 10% rate of return? It doesn't sound right to me.
It does not sound right. And it especially was not right in 1999 when lattes were closer to $2. He was also assuming you went and did it every single day, Christmas, Thanksgiving, the whole thing.
I just created a latte factor iPhone application because in the old days, I'd tell people, take out a pad of paper and write down your latte factor as you go throughout your day. Well, now those of you who are super hip and high tech, and it seems like it's everybody.
He then assumes a 10 to 12% average annual return in the market. Which, you know, even in the days of the internet bubble, not a lot of people were saying was going to happen. He then forgets to add in inflation and taxes. So when more reputable people take a look at this number, you end up with somewhere between $150,000 and $175,000. While that's certainly a nice chunk of change, we're not talking retiring a multimillionaire. But he went on to a great career with this. He went on Oprah. He's trademarked the term the latte factor. It is still out there to this day, constantly, as I think you know.
Now, you reserve a special circle in hell for CNBC and for Jim Cramer, the stock tout in particular. Why?
I think they are selling a false dream. Less than 1% of us, year in, year out, will be able to beat the markets. And in this group, I would include the vast majority of professional money managers. Least of all is Jim Cramer.
Exports. But Bernanke gets it. The Fed is staying stock market friendly. He's staying the course. I am urging you to do the same. Mad Money will be right back.
When people look at his record, the best thing you could actually do is, the second he says to buy something, is to immediately short it or bet against it. And in part, that might be his stock-picking abilities, but there's also one other thing going on. He yells out, buy IBM, a lot of other people are about to go buy it. And as a result, it's going to run up. And that has nothing to do with the quality of their business. And so what happens is, over a period of a couple of weeks, it runs up, and then it runs back down. So this is definitively not the way to get your stock picking advice.
One of your beefs is that the insecurities of Americans are being exploited, sometimes for big bucks. But it's not just adults, it's children.
That's right. The financial literacy movement, which really starts in the 1990s and picks up steam after 2008, and is very explicitly marketed as a way of saying, well, we don't need legislation to protect people because really they should learn how to do this themselves. And I just need to say that financial literacy broke my heart. The idea that we can teach children from ages 3 and up the basics of finance, the basics of budgeting, and this will allow them to be savvy personal finance consumers when they grow up. We have absolutely no evidence that this works whatsoever. And the groups paying for this, for the most part, are the financial services industry. You have to ask why. Because, of course, is it really more effective to try to teach people how to interpret a mortgage with gotcha terms that they won't see for another 20 years? Or is it more effective to simply pass legislation so that they never see that gotcha mortgage because it's illegal?
Sesame Street?
It was so sad. Elmo did a financial literacy series where he was learning to save his money. He wanted, I think it was a $5 toy. When you looked at the literature, it also had the bank's name emblazoned on it, which was PNC. We know that children who see brands like Visa as early as 18 months will remember the name and favor it decades out. Some of the people behind these programs have admitted that they are doing it in part to get their brand in front of school children and in front of their parents who might see the literature their children are bringing home.
So it's sort of the Ronald McDonaldization of financial services.
Right. It's like McDonald's teaching, you know, the food pyramid at school. I mean, it's not bad to learn the food pyramid, but you're seeing McDonald's name all over it, right?
Helene, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Helene Olin is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alex Hall. And the show was edited this week by senior producer Katya Rogers and me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.